Hey, I'm Jeremy Loeb. You're about to hear an interview with Senator Terry Van Dyne. She is a Democrat of Buncombe County. All right, Senator Terry Van Dyne, thanks so much for coming in. I always appreciate having you here.
Well, I love coming in, so thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, and so what I've been doing with this most recent string of interviews that we've been doing is kind of getting into background. We've had you in many times before, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners have gotten to know you over the years. But for those who haven't, could you just tell us a little bit about how you grew up and how you got going into politics?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Chicago, graduated from college, and worked as a computer programmer. So we moved quite a bit, lived in New York and then California and then Texas, and came to North Carolina when my son was in third grade.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And what was interesting about that and important about that was we knew that he was going to have difficulty in school. He was very late in learning to talk and had him extensively evaluated when he was 2 and 3 in Houston. And eventually they diagnosed him as being ADD. So when I got to Asheville, I went over to the public school, Estes Elementary, with all of my documentation on his evaluations and presented it to the principal. And they put him in a classroom with just a wonderful teacher. And it was so obvious to her what his problem was that she thought I was keeping it a secret. But I was volunteering in her classroom, and we became friends. And one day she took me aside and asked me if I had ever had him evaluated for autism. Well, needless to say, that changed our lives. And I found out later that North Carolina at the time led the nation in awareness of autism because something called Division Teach. And Division Teach did outreach to teachers about how to identify and work with children on the autism spectrum. Well, what's interesting about Division Teach, I learned, was that it was created by parents who went to the General Assembly and said to them, we need to do something about the situation of the ever-growing number of children with autism. And that's how I got interested in public policy and eventually ran for county commissioner. I came in last, but it put me in a position, unfortunately, when Senator Nesbitt passed away, to run for his seat. And I was appointed and have served in the General Assembly. This is my second elected term.
So how old is your son?
He is in his 30s now and doing quite well. He's worked all his adult life and lived independently. And so I am grateful every day and aware of how the investments that we make in our community can have a big impact in our lives.
What were some of the struggles that you would say he faced growing up, you know, being on the spectrum, and some of the challenges that you faced as a parent, do you think?
Well, you know, when you don't understand what you're working with,
yeah.
All right, you don't understand the behaviors that you're seeing, it's hard to know how to address them. And Teach was very helpful, and so was the Autism Society of North Carolina. I got involved with support groups, and it was just very helpful to have an advocate in the school, and that advocate was his teacher. It also gives me the opportunity to do a shout out to teachers, because what's unique about them, my son had a number of mild deficits, so every specialist I took him to saw what they did. And what was unique about his teachers is they saw the whole child. That puts them in a unique position to really understand what's happening with our children. And we need to appreciate that and encourage that and make them feel like we value what they do.
I see. Okay. And you, forgive me if you said it already, but you said so around 2 or 3 was when he was diagnosed with ADD. And then
right.
You came here to Asheville. And
it was, he was in third grade.
Third grade. I see. Okay.
When we finally got the right diagnosis.
Yeah. And then you knew how to deal with it. Then.
Right.
So you were born in Chicago, you moved around a little bit. Has your sort of political philosophy and values evolved over time, or would you say, how would you say how you grew up kind of shaped that?
Well, you know, I have 12 years of Catholic school,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't think about that until fairly recently, but I really think that I grew up in the 60s and went to Catholic school in the 60s, and it was all about social justice. And I kind of got away from that for a while as I was a young adult and working on my career and my family. But it's been kind of great to go back to those roots and really think about social justice.
It kind of stayed with you.
Yeah, it really did.
Yeah. So did you have heroes that you kind of looked up to in that movement when you were living through that?
I don't know about heroes. It was just more growing up in an environment where we together wanted to move the needle, you know, back then and still, you know, we're not finished with this yet. You know, the whole racial equality emphasis of the 60s and 70s, we're not finished. And now with gender equality, we will just be a better place if we keep working.
How was that experience for you? Like, I guess I don't know how involved you were when you were younger, but I assume that, you know, it probably started out where you kind of felt lots of adversity, like it was a huge mountain to climb, so to speak. And now you're in the legislature, you're in the minority party in the legislature, so it's a very difficult position to be in, I assume, because it's hard to get your bills heard and get your voice heard. So do you draw any parallels?
Well, let me tell you, I have this big advantage. I have never been in the majority. I don't know what that feels like. Mm-hmm. And I just get a new challenge every day. And it motivates me to want to do more. It's frustrating occasionally, especially when I have bills that I think should be no-brainers and can't get them heard. I usually try to find a Republican to run those for me.
I see.
And I've been a little bit effective that way. Mm-hmm. But it's frustrating sometimes to have to do that, but it's part of the job. And I am also working with organizations like Common Cause to kind of, you know, I think regardless of where you are on the spectrum, I think all of us agree that we have gotten too polarized. And I think one of the ways to mitigate that polarization is if we can get to a point where we're doing nonpartisan redistricting. North Carolina has been a purple state forever, and our politics don't reflect that. And we need our politics to reflect who we are. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of great work being done right now on nonpartisan redistricting. I'm not hopeful that we'll do it in the legislature, but I'm very hopeful that the courts, particularly the Supreme Court, will realize that because of the technology that we have now to assist gerrymandering in a very partisan way because of big data mm-hmm. and big computers, our districts are getting way too efficient. By efficient, I mean politically efficient.
Yeah.
And I believe that the Supreme Court is soon to say that that is really not constitutional, that we've gone too far and we need to dial it back. And I think that'll help bring us to the center where North Carolina traditionally has always been.
It was interesting. I was just talking to Susan Fisher about that very same thing. And Susan pointed out she really actually benefits personally as a politician from a gerrymandered district because she's in a very safe district. I think yours is pretty safe as well.
I won with 75% of the vote in the last election because I didn't have a Republican opponent. Now, you know, the folks in Buncombe County deserve that choice. And they didn't get it. So that's not right. That's not democratic.
So you would prefer to have a more competitive district for yourself if that was for the better of, you know, the entire landscape of North Carolina?
Well, then we have debate. And that's how we move forward, if we have open-minded debate on these issues.
How do you approach running when you don't have an opponent necessarily? I know you had a Libertarian opponent.
Well, I show up,
yeah,
okay, for as much as I possibly can, but I also, it gives me the freedom to work for other candidates.
Right.
And I got to meet a lot of really fabulous people on the stump for them. Mm-hmm. And I continue to do that because it's important to me that we get to a point where our legislature actually represents mm-hmm. the people.
This is kind of a tough question, but what do you... What do you think that Democrats did wrong in the last election? Because, I mean, obviously they did some right. I mean, they obviously won the governor's race and the state Supreme Court race. But a lot of people have been telling me that the goal was to try to get enough seats so that they could maintain a veto if Roy Cooper got a veto. So what do you think when you look out, what do you think Democrats needed to do better?
Well, you know, we can always do more. That is a hard question. Some of the people who come to me think it was because we were not progressive enough. And that's a legitimate argument. I am very encouraged by the number of people, and many of them are Bernie supporters, mm-hmm. who are saying, okay, we want to get involved now. We want to influence the direction of the Democratic Party. And I think the more people get involved, the more we'll get a bead on who we are. I really don't think we erred in not being progressive enough. We just couldn't get our message out. The Trump wave was just so loud.
Right.
Now, there are a lot of factors, and I am not by any means saying that we did not make mistakes, mm-hmm. but I think we could have corrected a lot of those mistakes and it wouldn't have made a difference.
I see. Yeah.
It was, you know, and it began in the primaries. If you look at the amount of attention Trump got in the debates versus the other Republican candidates, mm-hmm. that was unprecedented. So I think there's a lot of blame to go around in terms of what we did wrong and what we might do better. But right now, what I'm focusing on is showing up and connecting with as many people as possible,
yeah.
so that I can hear what they're saying and understand what they're saying and then represent what they're saying. And I think that's the way we all move forward together for 18. And if we get slightly better districts, I think that combination of a fairer playing field and broader enthusiasm can help us rebalance this state. Because I profoundly think that we are out of balance now, that what's happening in the legislature is not who we are.
I see. Okay. And what is your take on how the session has gone so far? From the outside looking in, from my perspective, it seems like things have been pretty contentious already between especially the executive branch and the legislature.
And that's truly unfortunate. Governor Cooper has put together a truly remarkable team. And for the General Assembly to be fighting that team, I think is just a waste of time. But to be perfectly honest, we have been in session, I think, this is our sixth week, and we're not doing hardly anything. The Republicans are still caucusing behind closed doors. So I don't really have a sense yet what, at least in the Senate, mm-hmm. what their priorities are going to be. I'm very excited about the announcements that Governor Cooper has already made about his priorities with the budget, and I'm hoping that they will give him a fair hearing. But it is remarkably quiet in the legislature right now. We have only taken up two bills in the Senate, and that seems rather ominous, kind of like the weather. You know, it's kind of nice in a way, but you're just wondering what's going to happen.
You're in the calm before the storm.
Like,
yeah,
exactly.
You're in the eye of the hurricane right now.
And are we going to have a blizzard or what?
So it's similar to last session in that you as a Democrat are being largely shut out of basically the stream of information. You seem to not know what they're planning.
We've only really started having committee meetings recently.
I see.
So it actually seems much worse to me this year.
Really?
Than it has previously. And
do you think maybe some of the emphasis has shifted to the House, maybe to put forward bills before? Could that be what's going on?
You know, quite honestly, my perception anyway is that the House and the Senate Republican caucuses work relatively independent of each other. Now, they're trying to address that. Appropriations meetings, our subcommittee meetings, are bipartisan. That's promising to me. But it seems to me that they're very late it's just hard for me to talk about what's going on when I feel like I'm totally being shut out of that process.
I see. And this is kind of what happened last session for you as well, do you think, as far as the Democrats as a whole?
Yes, but even more so this session. Last session, it seemed to happen after the House submitted their budget and we went into conference. That's when it seemed like we were being shut out. But now we're yet to be invited to the table, and we're fairly into the session.
There's, I think, like 5 or 6 HB2 repeal bills floating out there. But let's just focus on the one that Chuck McGrady put forward, because okay. It's probably the one, I guess, that, since it has Republican sponsors, is probably the one that they're looking at most closely. What do you think about what's been proposed there? And I know that the contentious part of that, like from the left, seems to be the part about the referendum, possible referendums.
And that's my problem. I am very grateful, I want to say, to Representative McGrady for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a huge step forward. It had to be a Republican to do this because they just were not open to our overtures at compromise. But you're absolutely right. The referendum, when it comes to minority rights, we just can't leave that to the majority. That's just not consistent with our Constitution. Mm-hmm. Our Constitution was written to protect all citizens' rights. And that, to me, is fundamental. And I think would be challenged in the courts anyway. So why not fix it? And I'm hoping we'll be able to fix it. I know Governor Cooper is working very, very hard. I think he's responded with a reasonable counter to Representative McGrady's request. And what he said is, okay, instead of a referendum, how about a kind of a supermajority, a majority plus one of any local government? And as a segue to local government, I think it's important that we respect local government's right to pass ordinances that reflect their communities, because our communities are different. We are not Charlotte, and we have different needs than Charlotte. For the General Assembly to say that we cannot have some say over our ordinances mm-hmm. is really an unfortunate approach to take.
Well, and when the Asheville District's bill came up in the House, there seemed to be a number of Republicans that got up and really kind of agreed with that fundamental principle of, you know, we don't live in Asheville and the people from Asheville have a problem with this. So why does this matter to us?
Right.
But yet on House Bill 2, of course, it became this whole other thing where, you know, Charlotte's done something, but everybody in the state's going to weigh in on what Charlotte did.
These are difficult issues. I respect that. But when you're talking about fundamental human rights, and I think we really are talking about fundamental human rights, that's not a good place to compromise. Privacy is an issue. Public safety is an issue. But I believe we have laws to take care of that. I don't think HB2 is about that. And I might point out that Buncombe County has done some really exceptional work around issues of domestic violence and sexual assault that is exemplary. And if the General Assembly wants to move the needle forward on public safety, I think they need to come to Buncombe County and we can give them some tips on how to really do it in a positive way.
Well, looking ahead to this session, beyond HB2, what are some of your priorities as far as the things you want to get done?
Well, we still need to make those critical investments in economic development. I'm very excited about working with Governor Cooper's appointee in Commerce. He's been over and we've had conversations already. One of the injustices I think the president has done about focusing so much on overseas is that he is failing to acknowledge the very real problem of the fact that so many jobs are being replaced by robots. And this is something that is really happening. So what we're seeing is companies are coming back, manufacturers are coming back, but they're only hiring, let's say, 10% of the people that they would have had before they left. So the jobs that those 10% are going to do are more highly skilled. So we need also to make those fundamental investments in education. Mm-hmm. And where we have seen investments in education be the most efficient is early education, to early childhood, pre-K programs, and even before pre-K, Smart Start, Nurse Family Partnership. Mm-hmm. These are all things we need to get children ready to start kindergarten. We need to invest more in our community colleges. We need to maintain our investments in our universities. We need to make our post-secondary education more affordable. And we haven't been doing a good job on that. We're moving in the right direction. I am grateful to my Republican colleagues for the investments they've made, but we have got a long way to go before we are adequately funding all of that.
What was your experience with the last budget cycle? Like, were you able to have some input as a Democrat?
In all honesty, not much.
Not much. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. But it may be different. Mm-hmm. I am just speaking for the Senate. It may be different in the House. And I will say that I was very grateful for Representative McGrady's input and the Democrats in the House. Mm-hmm. They took some pretty hard negotiating stands that I actually agreed with and made the budget better.
When the special session took place, you got up pretty forcefully when they were talking about, I think, the shifting of the power to the new superintendent because he's a Republican, I guess, was...
Yes. From the school board, okay?
And you used the words that what you're doing to education scares me. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, there's a reason why you have an executive board. Mm-hmm. And our school board is our executive board. And it's just a balance so that the superintendent cannot run amok. And the superintendent seems to me too closely aligned with the General Assembly. And that creates, again, an out of balance situation. Our school board was not particularly progressive, but it was kind of an independent check. And we have wonderful charter schools in Buncombe County. I love our charter schools, but we are on a collision course where we're pitting our charter schools against our public schools for funds rather than working on expanding the amount of investment we make in all of those schools. What I sensed when they made that move was a hostility toward public schools, which is not helpful.
When I talk to some of the Republicans out here in the West, like Josh Dobson and Cody Henson, they talk very passionately about their public schools. They, you know, came up in those public schools and it means a lot to them. And so it does seem like support for public schools on some level can be a bipartisan issue, definitely. I wonder what you thought about the recent problem that they had with the budget where they had mandated the class size, and
yes,
then they needed to fix that because
yes,
of PE and arts. And I was reading some op-eds in newspapers where people were saying, why do we have to change the class size back instead of just funding more?
Right.
And I wonder what you think is, because it seems to me like there is support from definitely from both sides of the aisle for more funding for the things like that, I would think.
And this is an opinion because, of course, I do not sit in Republican caucus meetings.
Right.
So I was not, there was not a single Senate Democrat on the conference committee for the budget last year. So this is a perception. But what seemed to me was that the House and the Senate disagreed on funding for teacher assistants. And the Senate really did not want to fund teacher assistants. Mm-hmm. They wanted to fund a reduction in class size and felt that they had funded a reduction in class size. So when the House hung tough on funding for teacher assistants, and I was very grateful for that, the Senate said, okay, we will give you your funding for teacher assistants, but we are going to make sure that you spend it the way we want you to spend it, and we're going to take away flexibility with respect to class size. Now, prior to this disagreement, Republicans, conservatives believed that the running of our schools was best done locally. What Buncombe County did, and I can only speak for Buncombe County, but what Buncombe County did with the flexibility in class size is they used a little bit of that. In other words, so if class size was mandated at 17, they might take it to 18 or 19, but then use that funding to provide art teachers and music teachers and PE teachers and technology specialists, all things that are very valuable to what Buncombe County residents want for their children. Other school districts may feel differently about that, but that's important for Buncombe County residents. And so what we've done by taking that flexibility away is we've said, if you want those specialists, you've got to pay for them yourself. And in Buncombe County, that will cost $4.5 million. And so I feel very strongly that yes, reducing class size is a good thing, but teacher assistants, if you've ever been in a kindergarten classroom, oh my gosh, I can't imagine even dealing with 15 children all by yourself all day long, how you could do that. They're just so active at that age. So I am very hopeful. Again, it was Representative McGrady, thank you very much, who introduced a bill to provide some of that flexibility back,
right,
so
right.
that Buncombe County can make decisions about what kinds of staffing we need in our schools. That's flexibility that we give charter schools. Why don't we give it to our public schools? Local decisions are where that should be made.
I see. Okay. All right. Well, Terry Van Dyne, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. I love what you do.
Oh, thank you.